session number 20335, reel 4.
Arthur Clark, reel 4.
So he used the zoo at Marseilles because the keeper of the big cats was one of his manquisards. And consequently, he managed to get all this stuff there successfully, and it would be taken and put in a special bunkers at the back of where the big cats were. And it was said afterwards that the keeper of the zoo had a wife and children and didn't want to be involved, and provided that he wasn't involved, he didn't want to know what was happening. Whether that was true, I do not know, but that was, you know, one of these things that came out. Now, on the way back, when we got to a big sort of autobahn thing leading into towards Bordeaux, there was a whole great blaze of light, as if there were about 50 motorcyclists or so, all streaming along, undoubtedly because of reports of aircraft activity down, you know, south of the Bordeaux. Anyway, you as pilot went right down and skimmed, you know, along the surface towards them. All the lights went out. They abandoned their aircraft, and you could see them in the moonlight running up to a little woods just the other side of the hedge. And so pilot went up and down a few times to discourage them, and then went away for a couple of minutes and then came back on a reciprocal. And there they were, the bravest of them, running out back towards their motorbikes. But of course, as soon as they had the aircraft back, they went into the woods for safety. And so the rear gunner said he'd have a go at trying to discourage them by having a go at the motorbikes, you see. And so the bomb aimer sort of said no sort of style, so, you know, the tail would, you know, be lifted. And he had a go on them, and the aircraft hung around there until the engineer said, look, we better go home because of petrol and so on. And it was hoped that they would stay there another 5 minutes or so, thinking perhaps they'd come back again. Anyway, it appears that this man got all his stuff away temporarily, you know, and they were just getting a bed when the whole area was swamped by the motorcyclists and people going down the lanes and all around looking for activity. And that 20 minutes or so had probably saved them, who knows. Anyway, we returned, and of course then we found out that Squadron Leader Reese and one other and ourselves had all dropped, and so we had three loads to put away, presumably for D-Day.
That, from your logbook, seems to have been the 10th of March, 1944.
Quite likely. Another interesting one is there. A long one, 9 hours, 50 minutes. Jean de Luz and Brits. Do you want one last one?
Yes, please.
Anyway, then on another occasion, remember, generally speaking, it was just one aircraft, you know, for a drop, except for this one south of Bordeaux, when there were three. But on one occasion, data's in logbook, all five names were on the board, operations board, Squadron Leader Reese, all five, because I thought there were six aircraft. One was always being used for training or a crew on leave, or a replacement coming in for one which had been lost or something like that. And so five were there, headed by Squadron Leader Reese. And in fact, the takeoff order was you first, ourselves first, because curiously enough, by this time, we were the most experienced. having done more even than squadron leader Rees, because as squadron leader, he didn't go on all of them. You know, he was busy organising and so on. Anyway, there we are, five of them, all for the same place. Now, we went to briefing, and we were given the briefing, and we were told that we would come down and we'd cross the coast in Cornwall and go down east of west of Brest and cross the Bay of Biscay and to a sort of a rock place off the coast of Spain there, and squadron leader Rees and two aircraft were to go to Biarritz and mine the entrance and also do a certain stooging around on like a square search. We and another aircraft were to go from the southern end of the rock on a time run down to Jean de Luz and mine there. The reason being that all sorts of valuable stuff was pouring through Spain, and rather than going over the Pyrenees, it was then going on boats just around and into sort of Jean de Luz and Biarritz. Now, also, we understood that there was something else on and that we were a bit of a diversion. And we believe that quite a lot of aircrew who had come down through Father Felix Kerr, did you ever interview him? No. Father Felix Kerr, mayor of Dijon and a resistance leader south towards Lyon, he used to pass them down to Francis Kmart's, who passed them on down to perhaps Star. Did you Star? Down near the Pyrenees, or one other agent down there. And he had a bit of a build-up, and he wanted to get him across the Pyrenees. And they used black marketeers who went regularly over the Pyrenees, came back, and for a very considerable sum, they had agreed to take them. Now, it is understood that that we would cause a bit of a diversion, you know, because it was the first half an hour, which was so vital to these people, because, as you know, they couldn't go in daytime because the passes were controlled by milice, you know, French police favourable to the Germans, or by Germans with dogs. And they couldn't go in on dark nights, they'd probably slip or something, and so moonlight was a chance. Anyway, the black marketeers were the key people, and so it is believed that something like that, you know, was happening. Anyway, we went, and just at the end of briefing, by the way, there were only four aircraft because one pulled out with a magneto drop or something, you know, bad with the engines. So there were now four. Squadron leader Rees's navigator, who was station navigation officer, and three others. And at the last moment, a naval officer who was there said, "Look, may I say that these navigators are plotted from the south of that rock." Now, he said, "We know that rock. The north side, where they are going from the north side, sorry, they're going from the north side, that is fairly flat. We don't expect there to be any, you know, machine guns or anything there, but if there were, they would be on the north side, certainly not the south." So he said, "You might consider routing from the south instead of the north." And so squadron leader Rees's navigator and myself said, "Right, we'll do it." But time was running up, you see. It was raining. The crew bus was outside. the pilots, all the rest were at the aircraft waiting, because the navigators were always the last, because you had to do a flight plan in case anything happened to you, so they had something to work on to get at least back to this country. And so the two others said, "No, look, we'll stick to the northern end." And they went out to the crew bus, and so we were a bit pushed. Anyway, we stayed and did it to the south. When we got out, the crew said, "Where on earth have you been? It's nearly time for us to go." So explained very briefly and said, "Look, we're running from the south instead of we've altered it, so we'll run parallel to the coast and up to the southern end and in." All right, fair enough. So we take off, and it was a lovely moonlight night. The Met winds were spot on. It was really good. We were able to get wind checks to the coast. They were spot on. Then there was nothing, of course. You were too low for astro, and with the moonlight and the brightness and one thing and another, and no pinpoints or anything like that. And so it was a godsend to have good Met winds and everything. And then we had a bit of a bonus because the flak went up at Brest and, quick bearing. And then a bit later on, another one which gave a good angle, so you were able to move the one forward and get a fix or most probable position, and another win. Everything was dreamlike. Then all of a sudden, the pilot calls them changing course, and the wing went down, and we went out around a little flotilla of fishing boats, and we went around them, you see. So then got him back on track and on again. And then the rear gunner says, "God, there's an awful lot of flak gone up. There's a flak ship in the middle of that lot." We didn't know it, but one of our four had been hit and wounded aboard or something, and it was returning home. So that left three. Anyway, we went down and we got to the southern end and running parallel, and there's quite a bit of flak going up actually from the Spanish coast, but didn't worry us because we were well away. And into the southern end, did our time run to Jean de Luz, squadron leader Reese. Remember, he went to the southern end. He did his time run to Baritz, northern end, machine gun fire, one of our aircraft gone, no survivors. You see, there's a lot of luck in it. And dropped the mines, three each actually, at timed intervals. Did our stooging around until the time was up, quite a while. And by which time probably would be a couple of fighters on the way or something. And then headed home. Very uneventful, for Reese and us, and back, and then we heard what had happened, because there were only two aircraft, and one, unfortunately, the one who was injured wasn't too badly injured. He survived.
Looking at your logbook, can I just go through these SOE missions that you've got here, see if there's anything you remember about any of them? 10th of February 1944, you've put moonlight operations as detail, Maquis, but it doesn't say where to.
No, they didn't tell us. Those were only rough areas remembered. We weren't supposed to put latitude and longitude or places in the logbook.
But the others do give places. For example, the next night, the 11th of February 1944, it says Toulouse.
That's where that was. Kmart's. We dropped him a lot of money.
Anything you remember about that?
Yeah. And a few anecdotes I found out afterwards which tie in.
What do you remember about from the time that you did it, though?
Yes, I can remember. I can remember the engineer coming back and what he said. And I remember things which are unusual.
Can you tell me, please?
Certainly. Well, it's another on the operations board. Engineer goes out as usual, scouting around, comes back and says, very unusual, there's an armed guard, there's a ring of steel around our aircraft. And he said, it's a fair way because it's full tanks. Well, we had the briefing. All we were told is that we were carrying something quite valuable. It was to be dropped, and if there was any doubt whatsoever, it was to be brought back. Well, we went, and evidently we were dropping to him, and it included a large sum of money, because Francis Kmart's was then the paymaster for a big area. It appears also that previously some money had been taken into France by a Frenchman who was landed somewhere near Cannes, and he unfortunately absconded. You know, whether he went to the races in Spain or what, but you know, he just vanished. And Francis Kmart's was a man of very great integrity. I believe he was a Quaker, and he was in fact a conscientious objector at the beginning of the war, so he said, and then he heard what was happening and decided that tyranny had to be opposed. And so, with his great integrity, he was the paymaster, and a large sum of money was dropped to him. Now, whether this was anything to do with it, I cannot say. But we heard afterwards from his courier, Christine Granville, Paulina, I think her, no, Christine Granville anyway, that there was something wrong with the money. There were millions of francs, they were all right, but there were two packages there of brand new notes with consecutive numbers. They were brand new. Please stop me if you know all this, and, you know, don't want any. But in any case, according to this good lady, he took one of these packages to give to another resistance person, and he was stopped by two milice near Toulouse, and he was taken to the police station. Now, she got on her bicycle and got there, and she knew these two were milice. She knew they were corrupt, and so she approached them and went in and said, you know who you've got there, don't you? You've got the chief black marketeer of Toulouse. And she says, I'm his bookkeeper. Look, we've got some money. And she offered something like 500,000 francs or something like that. And also, you know, as black marketeers, we keep you supplied probably. Anyway, one of them was a nasty bit of work. And in the end, he said, 1,000,000 francs for me and 1,000,000 francs for my friend or the Gestapo. And she argued and said, well, look, if I go to all the other black marketeers, I reckon I can get 1,500,000 francs or something. Anyway, they came to some agreement. Neither trusted the other. The money was handed over. Kmart was freed. This was confirmed by him later. And that's how he came, I think, leave the area temporarily.
But what are your own memories of that trip?
Straightforward. Just an ordinary, straightforward, workmanlike trip. And that everything went. They flashed the correct letters. We flashed them back. The triangle was there. We dropped. We carried on for about another 12 miles south of Toulouse, and then we turned and came back on our alternative route. And so far as I can remember, there was nothing untoward. We suspected nothing. The little embellishment which you had from Granville, Christine Granville, came from her later to fit into the jigsaw, really. And you know what happened to her? Killed by a schizophrenic.
And then the next one says 15th of February 1944 to Geneva and Annecy.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that one?
Yes.
What are your own memories of that?
My memory of that is that it was so unusual. They said that there was a bit of an uprising likely to be there, and that this one, the word easy was never used. But I think it was said that there would be no problem in dropping, because if you went to this place, it didn't matter. There would probably be two or three or five or six fires going, you know, around the area, and you were to drop to one of those. That's all I can remember there. And that, again, straightforward, workmanlike. And I think actually there were one or two fires, but we dropped where we were supposed to, you know, at the triangle.
And then the next one is 2nd of March 1944, Paris.
Yes, that was where I believe François Mitterrand took over towards the end of the war. You know, when it was obvious the war was not necessarily going in favour of the Germans.
But any personal memories of that one?
Not really.
And then 7th of March 1944 to Haute-Savoie.
Oh, yes. I can. The chief thing there is somehow or another, on the run-up, we're in a sort of little valley, and I can remember the pilot having the Stirling almost on its wingtip, because it narrowed as we went down, and that I do remember, that was highly dangerous, but otherwise it went all right.
And then 10th of March 1944 to Mediterranean coast.
Yes, that was a longish way as far as I can remember, and there again I think everything went, it was just a routine trip.
Then 11th of March was the Gironde trip that you have mentioned already in detail. Then 13th of March was to Annecy again.
Yes.
Any personal memories of that one?
Only that it was quite a pleasant trip. Big lake.
Nothing special. And which operation was it that you aborted where you smelt a rat?
Over on the Jura Mountains, Swiss Mountains. It would be one of the later ones, I should think, or pretty soon one of the later ones, I would think. Anyway, it would be one probably about seven hours or so, because it's a long way. May I have a look? I might be able to.
You've just looked in your logbook and you've got some guesses as to which the successful one.
Yeah, because as you can see by the ink, it was after we'd finished the tour that I felt able to write in just the vague area. We weren't allowed while we were on the squadron. And I've been unable to find the Latin Long through your headquarters. I actually had someone who was extremely good and who's given me details of all the others, but said it just said special operations.
Anyway, you think that the aborted one might have been the 7th of March one to work?
I think it might well have been. It's that area, 8 hours 15 minutes.
And you thought that successful one you described in detail might be from February?
Yes. Our rear gunner, Trevor Malloy, stayed on in the service as squadron leader. Now, his logbook is interesting, but of course it's in Vancouver, where he now lives. He did a first tour with the only Bomber Command Canadian VC of the war. He did his training and 29 operations with Ian, Willoughby, Beetlegeet. And he was invited to stay on or to go back later on with Beetlegeet, but he said no, because he was courting Beryl, that's his present wife, and Beetlegeet was just over the coast in France, one of three aircraft attacking a flying bomb site. And so the first aircraft went in and was shot down, and I think the second one went in and was badly damaged. Then Beetlegeet went in and he was hit and mortally wounded, but he managed to, aircraft on fire, he is able to lift it and give the order abandon aircraft, and two got out. And because of the two who got out gave similar reports, he got a posthumous VC. Also, this Trevor Malloy was our rear gunner because he was at Stradishaw as gunnery leader, where I was, and we went back on together on a second tour. So he wasn't on the first tour, he was on the second tour, which was Mandrel Screen Special Duties, from a place called North Creek.
Norfolk.
In Norfolk. I've got the valedictory service.
How did you like doing this mandrel work?
Well, it was almost back to main force work, really.
Any episodes from that work that stick out in your mind?
Well, the one I've already given you, the last raid of the war. Other than that, they were fairly straightforward. You did your mandrel screen, and then you were tail-enders, went in and attacked, and then mandreled on the way home. I've got some notes, actually, which gives time and all sorts about the mandrel activities, which I'll look out for you if you wish.
Who was operating the mandrel in the aircraft?
The mandrel was operated either by a specially trained wireless operator, or in some cases a special person was carried with very, very special equipment. Sometimes also, as I mentioned, there would be a German speaker who would use RT, you know, to give false orders.
Did you have any hair-raising escapes?
No. Except that we were so upset. The last raid of the war, we lost 14 of our people, and they were nearly all second tour.